All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Helper.
You are Katie Helper.
Tis I, Katie Helper.
You look very bright and happy today, Katie.
It's funny. I was just saying, don't be fooled by the glasses. I should say, don't be fooled by my bright and happy demeanor. Inside, I'm feeling Taibbianly dark.
That's funny. I don't feel terribly dark inside.
Oh, really? I'm carrying your emotional energy.
It's a body transfer movie.
It's a body transfer, yeah.
Right? Like, so who's in it? It's Steve Martin and... Who is that Olive other actor? Yeah, All of Me, right?
All of Me. So, all right. Yeah, who will I...
Not
who
Liv Tyler. It's
God. Alicia
Silverstone.
Lily Tomlin. Yeah, because we're confusing her with Lily Taylor.
How did that happen?
This whole thing.
No, right. I like that. Liv Tyler, Lily Tomlin. That's not so far off.
Right. What are some of the other... There's another... What's the Alicia Chris Rock Silver. body transfer movie?
Oh, does he have a halo? Is there a halo involved?
I forget, but he's like the sort of soul of an old white dude is reincarnated in him.
Oh, interesting.
We should make a list of the best and worst body transfer movies.
Yeah. Then Big isn't body transfer. That's just age transfer.
It's kind of a body transfer movie. I mean,
Freaky
I think
Friday,
that counts.
The change up. Yeah.
Down to Earth.
Down to Earth is the Chris Rock vehicle.
Right. So we're in a body transfer movie. I'm feeling pretty good, but look terrible. And you're feeling kind of dark inside, dark, but look good. So
yeah.
That's a good place to start the show. We have a great show. We have Pulitzer Prize winning reporter/author Christopher Hedges on to talk about some things that we're going to get to in a minute. It is very apropos to have him on this week.
Yeah,
and a lot of stuff to get to. A lot of interesting news.
Matt's health is good. People were worried. People who don't watch, who mistakenly and maybe out of ignorance, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt, who don't watch our Monday morning live show on YouTube where we go over the Sunday morning shows.
Mm.
I like that for seamless. We did establish that Matt was still alive, but I guess Matt, you put out on your own Substack, and we had to put out on this podcast that you had lost your voice. So
I did. I lost it for 2 days there. It was pretty bad. I thought I had COVID.
Oh yeah, that's the other news. We didn't want to. Here's an exclusive. You heard it here first. Learned it here first, ladies and gentlemen. We did think that Matt may have had COVID.
Yeah, I had to drive myself to a testing spot in the middle of the day. It was pretty horrible, but mostly through it now. So all's good.
All's good. And Matt did, I'm not outing you, Matt got vaccinated. I think a lot of people think you're on the, because you have a principled stance on censorship, I think some people think you're on the ivermectin train.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm not taking ivermectin. No. Yeah. And I have been vaccinated, and I've repeatedly said that everybody should get vaccinated.
Yeah.
But all right. So lots of stuff to talk about. Should we just dive into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So for Democrats Suck this week, there was a lot of stuff to choose from. But I wrote a piece about this, so why not go over material that I'm familiar with? This could be either, honestly.
Right.
But I feel like it's more it's more of a burn on the Democrats than it is in the Republicans. So over the weekend, George W. Bush gave a speech at Shanksville, Pennsylvania, in commemoration of 9/11 because it was the anniversary. It was basically everything you would expect from a George Bush speech, except for one passage where he went to kind of an interesting place. And Matt, can we see that video?
The security measures incorporated into our lives are both sources of comfort and reminders of our vulnerability. And we have seen growing evidence that the dangers to our country can come not only across borders, but from violence that gathers within. There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home. But in their disdain for pluralism, in their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit, and it is our continuing duty to confront them.
Is that a devil reference? Same foul spirit.
Yeah, I mean he was very big on the whole evangelical good versus evil,
right.
But Yeah, so that it was very much Bushian language. It just brought us back to the War on Terror era. But the thing is, he's making a semi-explicit reference to January 6th,
yeah,
and linking the one to the other, for which he was amply and almost immediately rewarded by blue checks across the Twitter sphere, including, yeah, let's just look at a couple of them. Here's Bill Clinton.
Thank you, my friend. I can't wait. Thank you, my friend, for your powerful and much needed words on this difficult day. I started out okay, but yeah.
No, that was good. On this
difficult day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You have to do the
Clinton thumb.
The Clinton thumb. Keith Olbermann was an interesting Keith. One.
And there it is. I can't really do him. He's just super angry and self-righteous.
Yeah.
And there it is. Even George W. Bush now recognizes Trump, his supporters, and those who directly participated in the 1-6 coup attempt are terrorists, surely as the 9/11 ones were. I'll say it again. Trump damaged America in a way Bin Laden only dreamed of.
Okay. There's a lot to unpack there, but we'll get to that in a minute. And then here's Rob Reiner, who this one was fascinating to me.
All right. Let's see. What's his accent like? It's just kind of a generic. I'm not really good at these. I'm really kind of phoning it in. So maybe I should, you want to just read them.
You can't do a New York Jewish accent?
Yeah, of course. In George W. Bush's speech today, he talked about the America he knew, one of compassion for Muslims and immigrants. Sadly, it's an America we no longer have. Now the terror comes from within. We must all come together again to stand up to ignorance and bigotry.
First of all, he did a whole movie about essentially bigoted response to 9/11 once upon a time. The idea that George W. Bush presided over an era in which people, you know, had compassion for Muslims and immigrants. I'm not sure what America he's remembering.
But that's an
interesting way to put it. But the real whopper for me was the Olbermann tweet, because there's a whole bunch of things in there. First of all,
and that film, by the way, was shock and awe.
Shock and awe, right? Yeah, exactly. The comparison between January 6th and 9/11. I mean, you could have all kinds of beliefs about whether or not the folks who entered the Capitol that day were terrorists, but we're talking about mass murder, like intentional mass murder, with the 9/11 hijackers, killing thousands of people, knowing that that's what they were going to be doing, right? And you know, the other group is
suicide bomb, like committing suicide. Bill Maher got into trouble for this, for being like, say what you will about them, they're not cowards,
right? Like, yeah, exactly.
I mean,
that lost him his first show.
Yeah, yeah. You could debate, you could say, well, if they really believe in the after, whatever. But like, there's a level of commitment that they brought to it that the 1-6ers did not.
Right. I mean, they weren't even, they were showing up and taking selfies. And look, it got completely out of control.
Yeah, and it was scary, and there was violence, and then
it's nuts. But that's the heart of this whole thing. The thing that's so scary about this is that, what Bush is being praised for is for sort of blessing the idea that this brand of terrorist is the same as that other brand of terrorist. And suddenly all these people, and there was a pretty long list, all these people who spent the Bush years complaining about this massive extrajudicial effort to demonize and target people just by labeling them something, suddenly they're out of the woodwork and they're fine with this new idea, because we're gearing up for this new domestic war on terror, and they like it. They're going to be in charge of it. I don't know. I thought that was crazy. I think it'll be something that'll be worth talking to our guest today about. But it seems to me like the rehabilitation of George W. Bush, which kind of began in 2017 when he said some things about Trump
and his art career. No one could deny his art talents.
Well, the art thing too is definitely a big factor.
Yeah.
But to me, it signifies something significant with the Democratic Party, because they've kind of taken over the thought process behind the Bush presidency, which was, we just can't leave this safety, the security situation in the hands of democracy, which is too open and too free. We have to build an essentially extrajudicial secret architecture within government to oversee the security situation for everybody. We're going to throw out habeas corpus and the Eighth Amendment and all kinds of other things. And suddenly that's fine. You know, who are all these people that I mean, don't you remember the Bush years and how intensely people felt about all that? It's just so, so strange. And we, of course, we here at Useful Idiots remember Keith Olbermann's rants, early Russia rants, right, as being, you know, the Russia scum rants as being
Russian scum. Yeah.
The kind of early tone setters for that whole that whole crazy era, which of course is going to be erased from the history books as as being nutty. But this, you know, just to wrap this up, the Bush thing, like, I worry about.
Can we
this.
Just look at one more thing? I'm sorry, we just to hold on. So for those people who are just watching the show, this is Olbermann draped in a flag, like literally draped in a flag, looking kind of.
He looks miserable.
He looks miserable, scared.
You know what that is?
What?
You know how, like, when you come out of a mass shooting or something and they put you in the back of an ambulance with a blanket around you?
Totally, yeah. Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Except it's a blanket that's shaped, that's in the pattern like the American flag.
Right. Which should happen after every mass shooting because they're so American.
Right. But maybe it's not, you know how the joke now is that they do that to everybody, whether it's a serious crime or not. So, like, he's just been removed from the scene of a shoplifting, for instance.
Sure, right.
Put in the back of a...
which is not American. That's transcultural.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Right, right.
This GQ article is called Watch the Resistance with Keith Olbermann. Donald Trump is our next president, which means Keith's not going anywhere. Catch every episode of his new GQ show, The Resistance, and then come join the fight. And at the end of his new thing... At the end of that show, he's always like, resist. And he puts his arm up like that.
Like that? Really? Up.
Yeah. Yeah.
That so there he looks a little bit more like a squid, actually, in that one.
You're right.
Or an octopus.
Squid. American octopus. It's like a Green Day album or something. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's like he's gliding over some rocks in search of prey. So the beak's in there somewhere.
Yeah. It makes the other one look very macho.
It's a little, you know, help me, I'm lost kind of a thing.
Help me, I'm lost. And even with my eight arms, I still can't manage.
Right. I still can't get out of the studio.
Yeah. But although octopus would be able to, they're very good at that, apparently.
They are. They're fantastic escape artists. Escape although artists. I'm going to go on record with a piece of trivia that I bet you're going to get wrong.
Okay, go.
Okay. What animal escapes more than any other from zoos?
Well, it's not going to be the octopus, right? Because that's the red herring, so to speak.
Mm.
Give me a hint. You don't believe in hint.
No, I'm not much of a hinter.
It's too much. It's too.
I'll give you a hint. Okay. I'll give the hint is that intelligence is not the factor.
Okay, got it. Are they a mammal?
Yes, it is a mammal.
Not an ape, obviously.
And you would think that actually orangutans are quite skilled at getting out of zoos. But it's moose.
Moose? Moose aren't in zoos, are they?
Yeah, they are in zoos.
There's moose in zoos?
Why wouldn't there be moose in zoos?
I don't know. Like, there aren't chickens in zoos. I'm just saying not all animals are in zoos.
I mean, you find deer in zoos all the time, elk.
Oh, speaking of moose, Matt, was this a setup or you really did?
It really wasn't.
Moose? Okay, so we want to give a shout out to Burn to the Future. Cornell Westest, who made a presenting the Useful Idiots Moose Wig Party founders. Thank you so much for that. But you want to tell people about the backstory, Matt, while I get actually another Moose Wig Party image ready?
I don't remember the backstory.
We were talking about third parties and how you had written a piece saying that we need the third parties to end the war industry, basically.
Right. And I think we were talking about the bull moose party and the wigs.
Yeah.
And that's how it ended up being moose wig, except it's not WHIG. It's moose wig. But I like the idea.
Well, someone named Boris sent me this.
I like that. That's
good, right? It says Useful Idiots Party and it has a moose.
I love that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of Ren and Stimpy-ish.
Yeah. Look at that shadow work too.
That is really good. I want that on a t-shirt.
All right, let's do it.
I want my children forced to wear that for their entire
face tattoo, forehead tattoo. Yeah, forehead. Yeah, maybe neck if we're feeling generous.
Oh man, that's excellent. That's that is really well done. Who do we thank for that?
Or so that's from Boris.
Boris.
It's just a sketch. If you like it, let me know. I clean it up. Wow.
I like it that way.
I like also if there's something you if you felt like there's something missing, dreidel sequins, large colorful beach balls, or Matt Taibbi's deltoid with an MJ Forever tattoo, please let me know as well. These can be worked in. What's MJ?
Probably Michael Jordan, I'm guessing.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So this is some anonymous friend of the show.
I love it. I love it. Spasibo, Boris.
Yeah. Thank you. Spasibo, yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
One final thing on the Keith Olbermann thing is, remember he used to say, and he, of course, is the author of Trump is fucking crazy. But remember he used to say it's been X number of days since Bush declared mission accomplished?
Right.
So what Bush gave that speech in May, on May 1st, 2003. So how many days ago was that from today?
Ooh, I don't know. I'm not the savant that's going to count 17, 18 years times 365 days. Somebody's going to have to do that math for me.
605,070 days.
But we, you know, don't let's not forget. I remember because I was reading. I read this in Chris Hedges' book. That remember when Michael Moore called out Bush and when he got his Oscar?
Yes.
That he recounted going to see the reaction on TV afterwards and watching Keith Olbermann rip him for it.
He was a sucker even back then.
Yeah. So look, I worked for Keith. I liked Keith, you know, at once upon a time, but I think this, you know, to me, this is just kind of the Trump phenomenon. It's got people's brains bent to the point where they're now, you know, they're not, and that's ultimately the point of this, the story is that we're willing to go all the way back to embracing all the shit that we spent the entire Bush administration protesting because we were so, you know, we dislike
Trump so much,
Trump and Trump supporters that much,
right?
That we're willing to give them the treatment that
right.
tourists got back in those days. So
tourists,
I think that's, I think that's a scary story. But anyway, what do we have for a Republican sec?
Wait, I got to show you last thing, I promise.
Breaking news. We've come full circle to such a complete degree that on Sunday, Trump tweeted a complaint about, quote, Russia, Russia, Russia. The title of the 46th episode of The Resistance from last March 14th was, quote, Russia, Russia, Russia. I've made my point. So now that I think the outcomes, the seven different inevitable outcomes, are unavoidable, I'd like to go back and enjoy some of my life again, and I'm going to. No illness, no scandal, no firing. Just, I've said what I've had to say. It was as obvious as I made it seem. I give my work everything I can, so it's not like I can dial it back. And I think even this dim-witted world of American political TV reporting, which is still calculating how to get Trump's idiot supporters to watch their networks and still waiting for Trump to pivot, even it can carry this the rest of the way. So I am retiring from political commentary in all media venues. This is not to say a bed of roses and reconciliation awaits us. The post-Trump America will be relieved of his prodigious evil, but in its place it will have Trump as living martyr. That prodigious evil and rank hypocrisy and immorality of his supporters, perhaps a third of us, will not vanish with him, and I'm not sure that the democracy has not been damaged too much to deal with their lawless, unprincipled rebellion, and I do not see this country's politics truly healing in the next 30 or 40 years. But at least the bleeding will be staunched, and we will have a chance to alter a phrase I heard somewhere to make America, America again. Thank you for all the kind words and all the support. Have fun storming the castle. My work here is done. Matter of fact, so is Trump's. Resist, remove, peace.
How bizarre is that? I mean, wish, I hope people watch this, even if you're usually listening, so you could see Matt's face, but yeah.
He looks happy though.
Well, because Trump was finished in November 27th, 2017.
No, I mean, he looked like physically jazzed.
I keep checking the date. I'm like, am I wrong? No, this is from November 27th. 2017, and the video was called Trump is Finished, The Resistance with Keith Olbermann. It sounds like he was not, he did not accomplish his mission, Keith. Anyway, but I liked, I just wanted to show you guys the resist.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's a little bit kind of Spock, live long and prosper kind of a thing. Anyway, we should all just prepare for this because this is going to be the new thing. Like, you know, we're the tenders of the new war on extremism.
Right.
So buckle up, I guess,
buckle
for that.
Up, yeah.
So what do we have for Republican suck?
So for a Republican suck, we actually have, I'm going to go back to a Taibbi piece. This time the piece is going to be about how 9/11 is a great time to review Republican hypocrisy. And it is called The Anniversary of 9/11 is a Great Day. Don't worry, it doesn't end there. To reflect on Republican hypocrisy. I thought this was a great piece. I wanted to quote from part of it. So you write, I have a bit of a bone to pick with you, but first let me go to the part that I think is, you know, very important to review. A short list of the more, and your premise is basically that Republicans who are freaking out about the mandate, the vaccine mandate, have no leg to stand on because they were terrible on civil liberties. Right? Am I summarizing your thesis correctly?
I think that's about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I have the author here. Do you want to say what it is in your own words?
No, that's right. You got it. Yep.
All right. More, or maybe it's more like, well, that didn't take long. Within a day after Joe Biden announced his vaccine mandate plan, a conga line of exultant blue-friendly pundits rushed to offer their hottest hot takes on the many exciting authoritarian possibilities that might now be open with government on check on the last. So that's on the blue end. But on the Republican end, the Republican Party's collective response to Biden's mandate plan reminded me of the Zucker brothers' take on how to deal with adversity in a mature and adult fashion. And that's from Top Secret. And a guy, talks about how important it is to be adult. And then he blows his nose into his hand and freaks out and jumps through a window. And then you cite Republican Senator John Thune decried an extreme government overreach. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey called the vaccine mandate a dictatorial approach, while a Kentucky congressman denounced Biden's move as absolutely unconstitutional. Oh, and one of my favorite examples is Utah's Mike Lee, who clerked for Samuel Alito in the early war on terror years, said Biden was a would-be autocrat. Then you go on and you remind us of the stunning hypocrisy in the list of more obscene authoritarian practices Republicans rammed into being since 9/11, 2001, most of which have stuck with us in stubborn fashion ever since, like venereal disease. And you say they created a new term of war, unlawful combatant, which allowed them to unilaterally opt out of both the Geneva Convention and the due process protections of American criminal law. When it came to the growing population of persons around the world not charged with anything but in our custody, they asserted the right to kidnap and remove, this indefinite secret detention, any person anywhere, to remove to this indefinite secret detention any person anywhere in the world with or without formal charge, even an American citizen. With the aid of then NSA.
People forget, by the way, that case. That was the Jose Padilla case. And at the time, I think that was the case that got Glenn Greenwald into writing about politics. But it was a huge deal because it established the precedent that they can just take an American and just whisk him off to a Navy base somewhere and without a charge. Like, anyway, so.
Which I always thought was a little bit weird. Like, maybe it's this lefty internationalist, whatever in me. That sounds self-congratulating, but it's not supposed to. It's so, I get legally there's a difference between doing that to an American, to a U.S. citizen and a non-citizen. And I think that's useful rhetorically to reach a lot of people. But it's so weird to me because it's kind of like we probably shouldn't be doing bad things to people.
Well, no, I agree with you on that totally. It's just that we don't have a legal mandate not to do stuff to people who are not in
citizens.
The things that are, you know, granted in the Bill of Rights, they don't.
Right.
People who aren't American citizens don't enjoy them normally. Right.
For better or for worse. So it's for better or for worse. It's consistent.
Right. Yeah.
It's not inconsistent to do that.
Right. Now, those are the, you know, grabbing somebody off the street, stuffing them in a trunk, and then having them end up in Guantanamo Bay, it probably violates lots of international laws.
Right.
But not our own, you know, like, but the idea that you can do that to an American citizen was like completely new.
With the aid of then NSA director Michael Hayden, who's since become a star in resistance circles, they unilaterally put into service a surveillance program that mass violated the rights and privacy of every person on Earth, including every American, and bluntly violated our own existing foreign surveillance law. They created a secret master list of undesirables via the establishment of a program called the Terrorist Screening Database, TSDB, which had as a sub-project the infamous no-fly list. They ostensibly made assassination legal again, and gave themselves the right to employ their new targeted killing policy anywhere in the world. And they entered into agreement with telecom companies and other institutions that gave them ongoing warrantless access to the medical, educational, and communications records of millions of Americans and foreigners alike, and so on and so on. Republicans scarcely protested any of this until Obama got elected, and even then, it wasn't Obama's acceleration of the worst excesses like drone murder that was the problem. Instead, the Democrats' public flirtation with deploying a few of these tools in unpredictable directions finally triggered the Republican Outrage Center. An early preview of what that looked like came in May 2015, when congressional Democrats, in the wake of a series of mass shootings, tried to deny purchases of certain kinds of firearms to people on the no-fly list. And then you write, unfortunately, Republican complaints about such problems will be impossible to take seriously until the party repudiates its role in building the first war on terror. We didn't hear many horrified Republican objections when a CIA official boasted to the Washington Post years ago about its drone program. We are killing those sons of bitches faster than they can grow them. In fact, Republicans cheered when Donald Trump promised to bomb the shit out of ISIS and lower the standard for who could be droned, from high-level militants to foot soldier jihadists with no special skills or roles. And in fact, drone murders massively increased under Trump, and Republican lawmakers sure didn't seem to care much. Okay, so that's the thing. I guess I have no expectation that they need to be morally consistent. I don't, you know, I'm very, very critical of Dems. I think that they try, they fail. In some ways, their hypocrisy is more hypocritical, because they really claim not to be hypocrites, and they always attribute hypocrisy to Republicans. If you were actually to look at it, the hypocrisy is, there's just a confidence that the Republicans have with their hypocrisy that Dems don't.
Mm-hmm.
So there's there's a level, I mean, sure, the Dems are total hypocrites when it comes to, especially the, like, I mean, they're not even hypocrites when it comes to foreign policy stuff, because they're so hawkish. They've become so hawkish, and they have been for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to domestic, like, class stuff, they're such hypocrites. You know, they talk, but like, but I do think that they'll be taken seriously. These, and they are taken seriously, Republican objections to the mask mandate by their base.
Mm-hmm. And the vaccine mandate. Yeah.
That's what I meant. Sorry. The vaccine mandate. Yeah. Well, whichever mandate. Yeah. And I just think that I don't take it serious. It's obviously opportunistic, and it's not guided by principle for the elected officials. I mean, not like your regular Joe Schmo.
I guess I don't have any expectation that they would be consistent either. Although, well, there's a couple of things. Number one, you know, beginning with the Tea Party movement, I interviewed a lot of these people once upon a time. There was this idea that we feel betrayed by the leaders of the Republican Party because conservative principles were not put into place during the Bush years. So they weren't complaining about the constitutional violations. They were mostly upset about the spending, right? So that started with the Tea Party movement. And then, you know, you talk to a lot of Trump supporters now, and they will say that they personally repudiate the Bush years. They feel misled, right, the same way that, like, Obama supporters feel misled. I don't know how true that is, but it doesn't really matter. Like, yeah, the point is, after 1/6, for instance, it was very, very common to read kind of conservative message boards and, like, you know, in their blogs, these complaints about being put on lists, because there was this thing that started happening. People started getting pulled off planes. They had their luggage searched. If you had any kind of connection in any way to any of the people at 1/6, all these things started happening to you. Well, look, you can't complain about that stuff if you don't complain about the no-fly list and and the terror watch list, which the whole point of why people objected to that at the time was that it was a secret thing with no due process where you were putting people on lists and suddenly like they weren't getting into college or they weren't getting jobs or they weren't getting access to loans or all kinds of things. And they had no idea why. And that was just in addition to not being allowed on planes and things like that. And nobody cared back then. Republicans didn't care. So it's happening to them now. And
yeah, it just rings totally hollow, right?
Right. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
And then on the opposite side, you do have this embarrassing like capitulation. Well, that was, I mean, even with the no fly zone, that was an interesting moment where Dems were celebrating that. Was it John Lewis who was talking about it very excitedly? And of course,
I don't remember. Did he?
Yeah. And it of course had the effect of being quite Islamophobic.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. The no fly list.
Yeah. But it was celebrated as an anti-gun thing.
Right. Right. Was, yeah. Yeah. Well, that was later. I mean,
Obama, under Obama, right?
Right, but they had already instituted the no-fly list and the terror watch list, which were kind of related. And then there was another thing, actually, that our previous guest, Spencer Ackerman, wrote about NSEERS, which is a list for monitoring people from Muslim countries. It was, I think it was 25 countries, 24 of them were Muslim countries, and then they just sort of added North Korea to make it not look completely racist.
Right, that's
nice. But, you know, there were just so much stuff like that went on in the Bush years that was really just about profiling people based upon either their religion or where they came from or whatever it was. You know, there was never any objection to it because, you know, at the time, it wasn't a concern of people, you know, in the Republican Party. And to me, this is a metaphor for what's going to happen to people on the Democratic side who aren't concerned about the censorship thing now.
Yeah.
Because this is going to come back and bite them.
Them in the ass, yeah.
But you know that performance after the vaccine mandate was like, was insane.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, suddenly we're worried about the overarching, you know,
overreach of government,
right?
Tyrannical government, yeah.
But again, you know, they're making the distinction that you're talking about, which is it's okay to do that to some taxi driver in Kabul,
yeah,
but it's not okay.
Or someone from Kabul, even in the United States, right?
There's also a stupidity there too, right? Like. When Obama droned Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son, who were, you know, al-Awlaki was an American. He was in al-Qaeda, but he was an American citizen. But that was like a massively significant legal moment because here's the United States government is sort of executing an American citizen without trial. Again, there should have been people who were at least thinking, you know, down the road, what a crazy precedent.
Yeah.
You know, if they can do that to him, then they can really do that to anybody legally. And instead of that, it was because this guy was somebody they disliked intensely because he was Al-Qaeda. Like they didn't think about the legal aspect of it.
Right. It is like you're saying, kind of like with the 1/6 people, right? Like with Trump, which you mentioned in your piece. In this piece, or is it your Bush piece, where you talk about how Dems, you know, got on board with all sorts of violations of due process with Trump?
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. You know, the raiding of Trump's lawyer's office, it should have freaked out anybody who has ever been through the criminal justice system. Like, if they can raid the office of the president's lawyer. And I get that there's an argument for why that was legal, because when your attorney breaks the law, then suddenly that privilege no longer applies, right? But it was kind of a thin argument to me, and again, the idea that they can do that to a president, it means of course they can do that to some low level. Yeah, exactly. You know, so that's freaky, but nobody cared. You know,
nobody
cared about any of that stuff. But yeah, the Republicans are tough to take. You know, when they start talking about the principled objection to, you know, this or that authoritarian policy.
I don't think I knew this until I read your piece. You write, we also didn't hear Republicans demanding. I knew about the forced rectal refeeding, but I didn't know about this. We also didn't hear Republicans demanding hearings when a Guantanamo prisoner had to appear for hearings seated sideways on a special pillow, his insides wrecked from years of rectal refeeding, since it was apparently okay with the bulk of the party's leaders that being in American custody now means having to submit to ritual sodomy in order to have having no right to trial. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I knew about that practice, but I didn't know that there was someone like Did that get any coverage that someone was actually,
it was in a New York Times piece, believe it or not. Wow. And the reporter did a great job of digging all that stuff. The reporter did a great job of
even I went through there, yeah.
Of uncovering all of that material. But it was presented in a story that kind of buried the lead a little bit. Like, you know, when you have person systematically anally violated to the point of injury, like over a period of years, that should be a blazing page one headline, right? And they kind of, it was in like the fifth paragraph or something like that. And even though the reporter did a great job, but it didn't, you know, like a lot of the stuff in the war on terror years, it was just like, well, it's happening somewhere over there, but whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Different time zone, snooze, as James Adomian once said. Yeah. And we don't have time to get into this, but we should mention it because it's so terrible. Maybe we can talk about it with Chris, but you know, the whole last strike, drone strike that America engaged in.
Oh, my goodness.
So yeah. He executed an aid worker who in Afghanistan. He was transferring water, right, into his car.
Right, right. And his kids came out to see drive, him.
Yeah.
And we lied about it.
There's a really good thing on it in the Times.
Yeah. And again, that's a kind of a rare example of reporters kind of following up on this stuff. Somebody called for an investigation when there was the Wall Street Journal called for an investigation into, but you know, a little late, you know what I mean? Like we've been doing this since 2002 or three or something along those lines. You know, suddenly we were getting morals about doing this stuff. We've been doing this all over the world.
Right.
We have bases for this all everywhere.
And his name was Zamari Ahmadi.
Right. And this is another Michael Hayden thing, because, you know, one of the things that they do is Hayden once said, we kill based on metadata. So a lot of times what they're doing is they're keying in on a cell phone. They have a cell phone number and, you know, they send the drone off. The drone identifies the location of the cell phone and, you know, boom. But a lot of things can happen even in the time between launching a missile and impact, which is how so many children end up getting killed in these things. You know, they still constantly talk about the capability for, you know, for surgical strikes and that sort of thing. So this was just so typical.
And it shouldn't happen to anyone, obviously, but it's so ironic that he was a 14-year employee of Nutrition and Education International, a U.S. NGO that fights malnutrition, and he helps start up soy factories, repair machinery, transport his colleagues, and distribute food from his Corolla to displaced Afghans.
I interviewed one, the relatives of an imam in Yemen, whose entire purpose was to try to convince people who are in jihadist groups to sort of mollify and moderate their tactics. Mm-hmm. And we blew him up in a drone strike because of a series of mistakes, right? You know, you can only imagine how that is received by people on the ground, right? Like they see that and they think, well, what wouldn't I do to oppose people like that?
Right.
You know, so
that's like the exact opposite effect.
Very frustrating.
And his brother and his children surrounded the car. So,
right, he was driving a Toyota Corolla.
Yeah,
right. They came in. He drives into the driveway, and I think the kids came out to meet him.
Yeah, they had a thing where they would like turn the car. They had like they would do this thing where they would get into the front seat to turn it. But
what can you say, right?
Yeah, so awful. And this is rich too. 4 days before Ahmadi was killed, his employer had applied for his family to receive refugee resettlement in the U.S. At the time of the strike, they were still awaiting approval.
Remember, Obama was the one who introduced the nickname Terror Tuesdays, because they used to have those meetings on Tuesday mornings to decide who was going to get blasted and who wasn't by drones. You know, just the idea that you would have a joking name for these meetings where you're blowing people up, and not only are you doing it, but you're pretty regularly screwing up and killing innocent civilians and to boot. I don't know.
It's... Yeah. And this included, I guess, 7 children.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 civilians, including 7 children, which again should just be all over the headlines. Like, what day did this happen?
It was over the weekend.
Was this mentioned on the Sunday morning shows?
Yeah, I'm not sure. No, this was a couple of weeks ago that it happened.
Yeah.
And remember, they initially reported like there were no civilian casualties, and then it came out the Monday after.
And his daughter says, at first I thought it was the Taliban when she saw it. Anyway, all right. How do we move on from that?
Yeah,
isn't that terrible too? Yeah.
Let's do something. So for isn't that weird? Again, there were a lot of good candidates this week, but I think we should just watch this Alex Jones rant. And look, sure. People That's are going fun. To preemptively, they're going to, as you just point out, that I'm going to take a bullet or two here on this one, because it's about ivermectin, and I've written about this topic, and we can clear up what that was all about in a second. But here's Alex Jones showing that he hasn't actually lost his crazy skills, or I guess you would say lost his crazy fastball over the years.
He's
still throwing 98. When it comes to that stuff. So let's watch this thing, which was pretty impressive.
Here, people. Overhead shot, please. You know what this is? This is ivermectin for humans. It won a Nobel Prize as an antiviral. And this is inhalable, or these are the tablet steroids. So let me show you. I was going to do this anyways earlier. See this? See this, Fauci? You see this, Bill Gates? I'm going to kill those prions, you bastard murderers. You're going to hit me with a bioweapon, you monster. You want to suppress me? You want to kill me? You son of a bitch! You goddamn demon! You think I'm easy to kill?
Goddamn demon!
Think I'm gonna roll over to your crap?
Is that a beer?
Or Joe Rogan kicked your murdering ass too. You'd love to bury him too, you little monster maggot. He's in this National Geographic piece about, oh, I don't usually deal with my enemies right away. I get them later. Yeah, you creep up on with a poison injection, dressed up in a lab coat, you little Joseph Mengele, Nuremberg Code violating monster. Nobel Prize winning for humans. 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 What, 2005? Nobel Prize winning for humans. Oh, Joe Rogan. He went and drank the horse paste. He's stupid. I bet he got it from Alex Jones. They're both so dumb. They're both going to be dead. Yeah, that's why Joe's worth like $300 million. Yeah, he's real stupid. That's why he lives in a $60 million house on the river. You leftists taking all the shots and dying are the dumbasses. He's the one that headlines with Dave Chappelle, not you. You're stupid. And I sure wish you'd wake up. But you sit there calling me stupid, an independent media person that built the biggest independent media operation in the world, that changed the whole paradigm with my badass listeners, and you sit around and laugh at us? Medical doctors gave that to me. It is incredible. It helped my family. It helped me. It helped everybody. And it's approved for humans for all sorts of viral stuff. But that murderer Fauci doesn't want you to know, because he wants the planet for himself and he wants you dead. Well, guess what, Fauci? We ain't rolling over and dying so easily, you little murderer.
Oh, my God. That was amazing.
You got to admit, he's got broadcast skills.
He does. He has pizzazz.
Yeah.
Yes, that je ne sais quoi. Yeah, seriously, we need to start broadcasting more like him.
I mean, it's almost like they had to have injected. That's not even amphetamines. That's like something like a cross between bull semen and strychnine.
Maybe it's a combination of ivermectin. Right. Maybe it's like synergistic.
Maybe. But man, that is amped up to the like nth degree.
Yeah. I mean, ivermectin, just to clarify, I lost like 100 subs on my YouTube channel because I had on Dr. Adam Gaffney, who is very measured in his approach. He's like, we shouldn't shame or mock people who don't get the vaccine. You know, we got to get people to take the vaccine. He's very much opposed to that like embarrassing idea that we turn people away for treatment, like Jimmy Kimmel joked about. But apparently there was actually a Washington Post piece that suggested that, like, in all seriousness. But, you know, ivermectin is treatment. It's not a vaccine. So,
right.
You know, but also it's like Adam was saying this, like, things can be healthy and not prevent or even work on certain thing. Like, water is healthy. You know what I mean?
Or they could be harmless. I think that's
harmless.
Probably,
yeah. They could be harmless.
The ivermectin thing is... It drives me nuts because I actually could not give less of a shit about this topic, yeah. But I've ended up having to write about, not having to write, but I've ended up writing about it like 3 times, you know, mainly because of they censored it out. And then because of this recent thing where there was this screw up about where they were reporting a story about people were overdosing in such huge numbers that they were blocking gunshot victims from getting treatment in an Oklahoma hospital, which turned out not to be true. But again, with the thing with ivermectin, you can say the thing that's true about it, which is that the FDA strongly recommends against using it, that there's basically no real solid evidence that it works either as a prophylactic or as a treatment for symptoms for COVID. Like the overwhelming consensus is that it doesn't work, right? However, there's a few things here and there that are true about it, right? And you should be able to concede that without triggering this massive response in media. Like the thing that Alex Jones is yammering about there about the Nobel Prize winning, that is actually true. When you just deride it as being horse paste, I think what ends up happening is that people see that and then they say, well, they're lying. Why are they lying to me? And then they're going to be more likely to go and take horse paste. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes, it's counterproductive.
Yeah, no, Alex Jones is something. Yeah, he's
the camera loves him.
The camera does love him, actually.
I mean, love hates him. Right? Because he kind of just looks like a commanding goblin, to use a turn of phrase. Well, he uses the term goblin a bunch, not commanding, but he's like a goblin.
Does he use the word goblin a lot?
Oh, yeah. He told me Hillary Clinton was a goblin.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you on his show?
Oh, no. God, no. I'd love to be. Alex, call me. No, I ran into him in Cleveland. I've shown you that video.
Oh, that's
RNC.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He's like, we're not going to roll over. He's so good on his feet. I'm like, hi, how are you doing? Are you enjoying yourself? Because I didn't plan it. I just ran into him. So I hadn't had my quest. So I was stalling. I was like, hi, how are you enjoying yourself? He's like, yeah, I'm enjoying myself. I always enjoy resisting tyranny. I was enjoying resisting tyranny. That's it.
He's on message like in 3 seconds, right?
God. And I was like, "What? Who do you prefer, Trump or Hillary?" He's like, "Well, Hillary's a lying goblin."
Nice.
And then he said, "I was like, any reservations?" He's like, "Well, I don't like the whole torture thing, but at least he's honest about it. Hillary's a goblin who's gonna piss all over the world."
Goblin piss.
Forget ivermectin.
No, if he drank goblin piss.
Goblin piss. Yeah.
This helps me. This helps a lot of people.
Maggot. Dr. Mengele. Oh my God, he hates Fauci. I mean, Fauci is not fat. I'm mad. We got to do an episode on this. I mean, it's the Dems are not, Biden is not doing everything he could to help get people vaccinated in other countries. That's bad for the American citizen. That's just good for COVID, bad for people.
Well, that's one of the big problems I have with, actually, I don't have a problem with the mandate theoretically. Right. It's the way that they've done this is it suggests to me that they're not really serious, right? Like if they really wanted to, if they were desperately focused on eradicating the disease for American citizens, especially with the idea of new and dangerous variants coming in, all you'd have to do is wave your hand and say, go with God, make generics.
Yeah.
And every other country in the world would take care of that problem by themselves.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't even have to give them anything. All we'd have to do is, but they won't do that because they've got like a favorite they got to keep.
So disgusting. So right? We should join forces with the people who hate, we should join forces with all those Republicans, call out Biden for different reasons. Get the and then use that to expose him on the real problem, which is the patent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we're going to do it. It is outrageous. And it just gives, we got to hold them hostage. We got to say, Biden, if you don't do this, we are going to unleash this knowledge on your enemies on the right. And they'll really go crazy. Not because they'll really care about they will care if we show. See, I don't want to make the argument for them, but it's talk about hypocrisy. Like, you're totally making yourself vulnerable to criticism because, as you said, if you really cared about it, you'd be racing to get everyone vaccinated.
Right, right.
The problem is people who are anti-vax don't want to advocate that. If they had the intellectual discipline, they could use it just to say, well, either way, they're being inconsistent and hypocrites. We got to come up with some working papers on this, a bipartisan. Yeah. It really is disgusting and disturbing, though. Like, they don't take it that seriously, or they take it seriously, but not as seriously as their the favors that they owe
Yeah, you know, Moderna and AstraZeneca and whatever. And look, the pharmaceutical industry is very nervous about this whole situation because the precedent that theoretically it could set, well, like, where do you draw the line? Like, oh, it's really, we really need to allow generics in this yeah. case. Well, don't we need to also do yeah, that do, for, yeah. you know, river blindness right. and AIDS yeah. and a million totally other things?
It's so fucking craven.
Right.
What can we do?
I don't know.
We gotta figure this out in a couple of episodes. We don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
I want to put those like Pfizer, Moderna, all those guys, the people who are making it impossible for people to get vaccinated in other countries easily, right? Mm-hmm. They need to live in one of the villages where people have not had access. Just plop them, probably. Just drop them right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or we stand outside their houses with, well, not a rat, because that's the labor stuff. So what's going to be our symbol of death for COVID? A bat? Because I think it's bat-related, right? We don't go back to the climate change.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, pangolin. That's great. We need a blow-up pangolin.
We do need a blow-up pangolin. We should have a massive metallic pangolin that we could drive to Washington, like an armored one.
We should.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll be shooting armored. Yeah, that's really good. And we'll shoot
with
we'll
flames shoot coming COVID. Out of its eyes.
We'll shoot yeah. COVID pellets at them. And at all the politicians blocking the vaccine, I would take out the big pharma guys first before I take out the anti-vaxxers. When I say take out,
hello, 911. There's a giant armored pangolin outside my house. Shooting COVID pellets at me.
Well, are you prepared to allow for generics?
Right, exactly.
All right, I relent.
I don't know. I mean, but you know, in seriousness, there's a you know, like this is why the whole like neoliberal project is fucked, because it's stuck between, you know, being married to certain models of how we deal with things. Like, you know, I'm not a socialist, but I think there's certain things that you just can't make a purely market. There's no way to morally deal with mass disease purely through market mechanisms. It just doesn't work, you know?
And it works for so few people. Like, how many people actually benefit from this system? With healthcare especially, it's just such a small number.
Well, this is the whole law of consequent, you know, concentrated benefits and distributed consequences or whatever it is. Like this whole idea that if there are a few people who benefit, they're going to lobby very specifically to get their thing. But if it's the damage is spread to everybody, they're not likely to rally together.
You know, we're not organized. Yeah, we need to be though. Also, pangolins are so hideous.
They are. They're like possums that with scales.
Yeah. You know what? I feel bad that I said that, because look at this. Hold on.
It's kind of cute.
It is. What do you think?
I don't know. To me, it looks like a rat mated with a pine cone.
A rat and a pine cone. Yeah. Pine rat. All right. Well, that is weird. So,
isn't that terrible? What do you have?
Or isn't that terrible? Here's what I got. Ready? A Twitter user insulted a German politician. Police then raided his house. It was 6 a.m. when six German police officers came knocking on the door of a Twitter user in Hamburg. What sparked the investigation? A tweet he wrote in June calling a German official a crude term that refers to male genitalia. The raid Wednesday came a little over 3 months after he replied to a tweet from Andy Grote, the interior and sports minister for the city of Hamburg, describing him as a pimmel. A pimmel, by the way, they don't translate it really, but a German friend.
It's like a willy.
Yeah. How do you know that?
I don't know. I've heard that.
That's exactly what we said it was like, a willy. Yeah. Mm. So they showed up.
It's not even like schlong or dick or anything like
that. We should put pimmel in the translator to see what it sounds like, to make sure we're pronouncing correctly. Because he called him a willy, he can be punished under a section of the German criminal code. But I think the police response or the security response was a bit overkill, and it backfired, and then it launched the hashtag Pimmelgate.
Love it.
Okay. So here's a quote from German professor Jeanette Hoffman. It is arguably actionable, that kind of invective against politicians, but this house search caused a lot of protest. Lots of people saw what this person wrote as completely harmless compared to what you find on the internet and all the death threats, particularly against minorities and women. This is laughable. It's they apparently the things that like the way you could, they have a lot more aggressive laws than we do in Germany about speech. You know, Holocaust denial is a crime. I guess calling your calling someone a pimmel is also a crime.
They've also instituted lots of new measures since the pandemic started. But I'm sorry, any country that allows you to send police through your door for calling a politician a willy.
Yeah. What kind of willies do that?
Yeah. That's like a 10 on the lameness scale, right?
Yeah. It's pretty bad.
That politician,
he deserves that label. That we should have, like, there should be art of him as a pimmel.
He should have to wear like a rubber
scarlet pimpernel. What is it? The scarlet. There's a scarlet letter, but isn't there the
Pimper? The Scarlet Pimpernel was a hero.
Yeah, so he should be the Scarlet Pimmel, but it bad.
Right. Yeah, I think he should have to wear like a little willy, like on the front of his face forever.
Scarlet. What about? I'm just trying to throw in Scarlet Pimmel somehow. Get that in there.
Pimmernel.
Pimmel cup, like a Pim's cup. Cup. That sounds like a condom though, or something.
Yeah, it does.
Pimmel cup.
What
a dick. That's what they should have called him. I don't know how you say dick in German, but honestly, Pimmel is too soft.
So to speak.
Yeah. No pun intended, or maybe intended. Yeah. Yeah. But that is ridiculous. Come on.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that politician was contacted sometime during that process. And if he didn't intervene to say, please don't fucking do this, I'll look like the world's biggest idiot.
Yeah. Like, leave my willy out of this.
Like if he even just assented to this,
right?
He's
complicit.
on today's list of the world's biggest assholes.
Yes. Yeah. Free willy. That would be a good meme also for it.
Right. Free Pimmel.
Free Pimmel. Yeah.
We could have the German version, right? Yeah. Except Pimmel, it wouldn't be a killer whale. What would it be?
Like an eel? Or a leech?
Yeah, like a really small eel.
Yeah. So we got to have the Pimmel guy, the guy who tweeted out the Pimmel thing. We want to have you on, along with the guy who created the penis sculpture. They both speak penis to power.
All right. Well, all right. That was the Four Foot Groups. And we have a great interview coming up with author, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, Chris Hedges, friend of show.
Yeah.
Are you excited, Kate?
I'm so excited. And also he's going to tell us a bit about his upcoming book, Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Lynn Hedges, and you can find his writing at sheerpost.com.
Chris Hedges, welcome back to Useful Idiots. Thanks so much for joining us. We wanted to have you on for a bunch of reasons this week, but in particular, in the wake of 9/11 and the sort of rehabilitation of George W. Bush, I want to read something that you wrote at the end of Bush's presidency first. The Gilbert and Sullivan charade of statesmanship played out by George W. Bush and his enabler, Condoleezza Rice, as they wander the Middle East is a fitting end to 7 years of misrule. Despots stripped of power are transformed from monsters into buffoons. One half expects to see him stand up at the next president's inauguration and screech, I'm melting, as he sinks into a puddle of slime. But he's back now. So how did that happen? Like
that sounds like Matt Taibbi.
I know, it does. It does sound like, I was like, are you sure
maybe
you
I was, just maybe I was your inspired. Own pieces? Maybe I just read something Matt wrote and but I could be cute and funny too. That's pretty rare for me. I don't even remember that.
No, that's a good one.
Oh, it's not just Bush, you know, it's the recycling of all of the, let's call them for what they are, war criminals that carried out these preemptive wars and eviscerated our civil liberties, and it's the whole collection of monsters in both administrations. By the way, Obama is not in any way immune from this. And so all of the critics, myself being one, and, you know, what was, I think, galling for me about 9/11 is that I wasn't just a critic. I'd spent 7 years in the Middle East, had been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I'd spent months of my life in Iraq. I speak Arabic. I should probably use the past tense, but I spoke Arabic because I didn't parrot back the dominant narrative. All these quote unquote experts who really were culturally, linguistically, historically illiterate about the Middle East and propelled us into what I would argue is the greatest strategic blunder in American history were given perches and amplified. Thomas Friedman actually had been in the Middle East, but like Wolf Blitzer, who used to work for AIPAC and the Jerusalem Post, right, had long ago decided which quote unquote side he was on. Yeah, and so there's a complete continuity. So the rehabilitation of George Bush is not surprising. He's just part of a long line of people. I mean, John Bolton, the rehabilitation of John Bolton, of all people. But as you have written, Glenn and others have written extensively, these are the only voices we hear. Brennan, and McChrystal, David Petraeus, God help us. That's it.
Yeah, he was everywhere during the Afghan stuff. It was amazing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Those are the only voices you're allowed to hear. And if you, even if you come like I do out of a background of the Middle East, if you don't spew back what it is the ruling elites want, then you're shut out. You're completely shut out. So yeah, Bush, who, as you pointed out in a recent column, is the architect in many ways of the unraveling of both internal civic life and the disastrous, futile, endless wars that have plagued the country for the last two decades. But, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that we've now split the country really into two camps. And it's not a Republican-Democratic Party divide. It's a divide between oligarchy and autocracy. So you have many Republican and Democratic oligarchs, or people who serve the interests of the oligarchic elite, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and the old establishment wing of the Republican Party, the Bush family, Mitt Romney. All of these figures are now united against a rising autocracy. That's the real political divide in the United States.
You have a great piece that you just wrote at SheerPost, right? The evil we do is the evil we get. Could you set up that piece? Because at the opening of it, you talk about being in New York City on September 11th and how it was actually in some ways familiar to you.
Sure, because this is the way we communicate. Huge explosions and death above a city skyline. That's how we have communicated for decades. In 1965, when then Defense Secretary Robert McNamara begins the bombing campaign north of Saigon, which eventually leaves hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese civilians dead, he calls it a form of communication with Hanoi. I was in the first Gulf War. I watched the waves of B-52 bombers strike Iraqi installations in Kuwait and in southern Iraq. I was in Gaza and have watched American-made F-16s piloted by the Israelis take out hold blocks of refugee camps. That is how we communicate with the rest of the world. And the hijackers learn to communicate back to us in the language we taught them. So when I saw that devastation, it was familiar as somebody who'd spent two decades on the outer reaches of empire. And so that was, of course, lost on most of the public at the moment, who drank deep from that very dark elixir of nationalism. And the flip side of nationalism is, of course, always racism. And that was lost. There were two things I thought that were lost at that moment. One was that this is how we communicate with the rest of the world, and they learned how to communicate back to us in the same language, and the other were the jumpers. So I was in Times Square. I was one of this brief interregnums when I wasn't overseas. I would go back overseas after 9/11. I was based in Paris and covered Al-Qaeda in Europe and the Middle East. But I was in Times Square right after the second plane hit. And I was actually early. So I walked into the New York Times newsroom, grabbed a cell phone and some notebooks and walked down the West Side Highway, was actually there when people were running from the collapse of Building 7. Immediately, when the people were jumping before the towers collapsed, that was censored out of live news broadcasts. So you had, some estimates are up to 200, but certainly dozens of people who leapt to their death in an act of mass suicide. And that mass suicide just didn't fit the narrative that both the media and the ruling elites were propelling, which was stories about heroic rescues and the virtues of America. And so that mass death and that mass suicide had to get converted into, in essence, an uplifting kind of narrative about first responders who, of course, would, many of whom would come down with cancer. I mean, okay. I was only down there for 24 hours. And then because I speak Arabic, I was sent to where all of the hijackers had lived to interview their neighbors, people who, to try and build profiles on them to the extent that we could. They were in Paterson, New Jersey, and other places. But the toxic fumes were, all of the reporters and photographers who had been there came back to the newsroom. We were all hacking because it was these carcinogens, not just fuel, but asbestos and all sorts of other stuff that was in the air. But I would say those two, the failure to understand that this has long been the way we communicate with the rest of the world, and then the inability to accept the deep despair and fear and hopelessness that drove dozens and dozens of people to leap to their deaths, that those things just were too unpalatable for the American public.
And of course, Christine Todd Widman at the EPA said that it was safe to be down there.
Well, sure, they wanted everybody to go back as fast as they could. Right. That's something, by the way, that we see in the Middle East. I mean, I was there for the highway of death. This was the Iraqi convoys that were fleeing Kuwait City. I actually was with the Marine Corps. We had fought in the last tank battle north of Kuwait City the night before. And then although I was in a Marine Corps uniform, drove my Jeep down what was the highway of death as thousands of Iraqi soldiers were retreating. It was one of these surreal moments of war where I'm in American uniform alone in a car driving past thousands of Iraqi soldiers. But then that got obliterated. And what was interesting when I went back up there is that all these vehicles were coated with this fine white dust from uranium depleted weapons. And then, of course, they sent service members in there to clean it up. And, you know, most of them got sick. Along with the burning, the dumps that where they burn huge numbers of military supplies and send off toxic fumes. So the sacrifice, the ruling elites are, despite all their rhetoric, are quite willing to sacrifice both their soldiers, Marines, and their first responders without much qualm of conscience.
Did it feel different to see it on your own territory?
Well, I would say, you know, when the buildings collapsed, it was a kind of moonscape. And it was just hard to digest. It was so surreal. I mean, when the buildings went down, you could reach up and pull out, for some reason, paper. I don't know, must be some explanation for this, but there was lots of paper that hadn't burned. But you could reach up and pull out a piece of paper, and it was from the 68th floor. And then 2 feet down, you could pull out a piece of paper, and it was from the 20th floor. It had all gone down like an accordion. And then there were bits of small, tiny bits of human flesh all over the place, including at one point a shoe with a foot in it and stuff. So it was clear that nobody had survived, because at that time there was still hope that somehow first responders would find people in the rubble. But for those of us who was there, it was immediately evident that nobody who were in the buildings when they went down had survived. It was impossible. So, you know, it's the shock. I don't think I ever saw that kind of industrial devastation. I had been in Sarajevo, but even then, buildings would get taken out. But here, everything, it was so vast. Even given my experience, it was kind of hard to process.
Chris, you're one of the few people who reported on the Iraq war without being embedded. I was just wondering if you're what you're, and I know you wrote once that war is always reported through the prism of the occupiers, and that, you know, this becomes a failing of embedded reporters because they only see what the occupiers see. I was wondering what your thoughts were on the occasion of the end of the Afghanistan war, because so many people seem surprised by the rapidity with which, you know, the rest of the country, quote unquote, fell to the Taliban, which seems like a mistake that people could only make if they were living in a very, very small bubble over there and had no connection at all to reality. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the coverage of all that as it unraveled.
I'm a little forgiving to the reporters and photographers who were in Afghanistan and as the Iraqi conflict heated up in Iraq, because it was just too dangerous to travel with the Sunni insurgency in Iraq or the Taliban. You couldn't do it. And I actually think that there should be reporters and photographers who are embedded in a conflict. The problem is you see a very narrow window of that conflict through, as you said, the eyes of the occupiers. That's the first problem. The second problem is that you don't see the effects of the weapons. A lot of these high-tech weapons, you're looking at infrared screens, there are little dots, there's an explosion, the little dots don't exist anymore. But if you're embedded, you're not going to go see the carnage that's been visited. And given the massive ordnance of Hellfire missiles or anything else, there's always tremendous collateral damage. That, and then also the problem with being embedded, and the reason I wouldn't do it ever, I've never done it, is that you occasionally will see things. For instance, colleagues of mine were at checkpoints where families came too close and they were all shot and killed. But if they report that, they're instantly de-embedded. They're out and they know it. So it's that lie of omission. And I just never wanted, as a war correspondent, I didn't need the military. I had more experience in war than the military, with the exception of the Vietnam vets, perhaps. I spoke the language. And I wanted to be a reporter. And if I couldn't be a reporter, I was going to go home. So that was a personal choice. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. And that was a very interesting conflict because reporters and photographers traveled with the army and the FMLN, literally switching sides, sometimes within days, between clashing units, very rare. And so it's a question of honesty. And by the time the conflicts became intense in Afghanistan and Iraq, those reporters and photographers, most people who cover war don't really want to go anywhere near combat, which is a very rational and sane response to combat. I get it, except you shouldn't be there. You shouldn't. They kind of pretend at being war correspondents. And I mean, one of my favorite moments in the first Gulf War was Schwarzkopf having these briefings in a 5-star hotel in Riyadh, and all of the press wearing camouflage uniforms sitting in the front row before they then trotted off to the hotel buffet. So it was all, when I covered the war in Salvador, it was only about 10 or 15%. Photographers, by the way, are more honest because they have to get out. So if you look at camera people and photographers in terms of fatalities and in terms of people who are wounded, they're a far higher percentage than print reporters who can go to the embassy and get a handout. And I would say, you know, about 15% of us, including photographers and camera people, got out. And the rest of them wanted to pretend that they were covering a war. That's true in every conflict I've ever covered. So when you had the pool system set up in the first Gulf War, it was administered not by the military, but by the press, the Judenraten of the press, the Wall Street Journal. I got their names. They know who they are. And they did the, you know why they did the work of the military? Because they didn't want to go out. They were quite happy to have the restrictions. And so that does characterize the vast majority of the press in war zones. And the problem is, for those of us who do go out, they make war on us. So for instance, I wasn't abiding by the pool restrictions in the first Gulf War, and all of the other New York Times reporters who were sitting in a 5-star hotel rewriting pool copy, which is garbage, because they just take you on a dog and pony show and show you, you know, how Marines can't wait to storm into clouds of sarin gas. And we all thought we were going to get hit with gas, which is why when I went in the Marines, the Army hightailed it around and did that hook around into Saudi Arabia and left the Marine Corps to deal with what they thought were going to be dumps of artillery shells, which all had gas in them. And he did have it. But they made war on us. So all the other reporters of the New York Times wrote the foreign editor of the New York Times and said that I was ruining their relationship with the military because I was going off. Well, what I was doing was filing original stories that they didn't have because I went out and defied the rules and reported it. But I had great animus, not only among the military, and I was eventually arrested and they took my, seized my credentials. I said, take them. I don't use them. I don't need them anyway. But also from within the New York Times itself. And I was only saved by R.W. Apple, who was this Falstaffian kind of figure, but who had been in Vietnam. And it, Johnny, his name was Johnny. We called him Johnny. He was a good writer and he did care about the craft of journalism or the trade of journalism is a better term. And he protected me, called all when the, he, they didn't clear the letter with him. And when New York got back to him, he called everyone together and gave them a dressing down and said, we don't work for the US military. And he saved me. But if he hadn't been there, I'd have been out. So that is an important characteristic to understand in the coverage. And because most of the press, and again, I would again make the exception for the photographers and camera people. Most of the press is pretty weak-kneed, pretty, they get to put on a uniform, ride around in a Humvee, and they drool all over the military who are real men because they're not, because, you know, they went to Brown University and I mean, wherever they went, what? Whatever Ivy League school they went to before they got to the Washington Post. Yeah, I mean, they used to drool all over Schwarzkopf. I mean, you go back and read this coverage, you would have thought this guy was Napoleon. Yeah, I didn't have much time for the military. I didn't have much time, but I didn't have much time for my fellow colleagues in the press either. I didn't have much time for me, so it was a mutual hate fest.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
Well, that was great.
That was great. Wow, was that great.
It was. It was.
We got to have him back again. He's great.
We got to have Chris back. And, like, you know, his experience is so relevant to so many different things that are going on in society right now, from the revival of the war on terror to, or at least to that ideology, right?
Right, because it never stopped, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Or it coming back into fashion again.
Yeah.
From that to the, you know, this is sort of problem with the collapse of trust in media. I think he was one of the first people who was on the front lines of what happened to the modern newsroom. You know, he got bounced out of the Times essentially for being right about Iraq. And the Times as an institution, I think, sort of systematically underestimated how badly that damaged its reputation. Maybe not specifically just with him, but how badly it screwed up Iraq, you know. So that there's that thing, and so it's really interesting to hear him talk.
Yeah, it is. He's a great speaker, great writer. Everyone should check out that piece, which we barely scratched the surface of, but it's a great piece at Sheer Post.
Very much looking forward to reading his book too.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, the evil we do is the evil we get. Yeah. Also, R.I.P. Norm. R.I.P. Norm MacDonald.
Yeah, R.I.P. Norm MacDonald.
And Michael K. Williams.
And Mike. Oh my God, friend of the show, Michael K. Williams.
Yeah, that was so sad. That was
really rough. I don't even know what to say about that.
He talked about his, you know, his struggle with addiction on our interview.
Yeah.
I mean, he talked about it openly on other interviews, but he was so nice. Like, okay, I didn't know him that well. We interviewed him once, but he was so kind and humble. And he was like apologizing. You can see in the interview for like the background noise. He was just, why can't we switch them out?
You know what? So
Kissinger.
He was amazing because, you know, that character of Omar was he was so far from what he was as an actual person. Like it just shows you what a great actor he was, that he was able to pull off. Because you liked Omar was a very likable character, but he was like ruthless and violent, and you know, and you know, he was unbelievable. He created something really iconic, and he was a really terrific person. And it's really sad that what happened.
Cared about, you know, incarceration. And there's actually at the very beginning of the interview, I asked him about his political consciousness, and he's like, I struggle with that word, being tied to that word political. I'm just I'm just someone from my community, investing in my community and the greatest resource in my community, which is the youth.
I mean, a lot of the people who were the cast members of that show, I think, ended up becoming activists of one form or another, you know, right. especially about the criminal justice system, because and they started to see the show as being, you know, a way to teach people about what was going on. And, and you know, and he was a big part of what was a rare high achievement in modern television history, you know. Yeah, it's really sad.
It's so sad. So condolences to his family.
Yeah.
So guys may or may not know, we're kind of obsessed with Charles Jaco on the show. Journalist was there in Iraq. Wilson, you want to set it up? Because you found it. Matt Wilson is obsessed with, we're all obsessed with Charles Jaco, but Matt Wilson is especially obsessed. Is that a fair characterization?
I think that's exactly the right way to put it.
Yes, extra obsessed. So tell us what you found on Charles Jaco.
I was doing my usual research for Jaco of the Week, and I found this X-Men comic, and it's nowhere else on the internet. But it has to be him, right? It's Charles Jaco, reporter. It looks like him. He's got the same mustache and the hair and the whole setup from when we saw him with his hands on his hips.
Wow. Wait, so this is an X-Men comic?
This is X-Men Volume 2 from 1992.
Oh, like this is a real X-Men comic. Okay, yes. I was like, of course it's him. It says him. But you're saying...
All right, I got to buy that comic.
Yeah, we got to sign it. He has to sign it.
Matt, make sure you send me that copy, the tweet there, send me that link so that I'm going to go grab that somewhere from eBay or whatever.
Maybe we should have, instead, remember Jon Stewart used to do Moment of Zen? We should have our Moment of Jaco.
where we get in tune with our inner Jaco?
Just show a Jaco related media clip.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I got to get that trench coat.
Yeah.
See that? See what he's wearing?
Oh, yeah.
There?
Oh, big
that's
time,
that's
yeah.
very, it's kind of like, it's like Blade Runner meets Arthur Kent. I kind of like it.
It has a kind of Ninja Turtles feel to it also.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. I bought an exact replica recently of the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock Holmes jacket.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. But I think I'd prefer to have something like that.
So we and Wilson, you were encouraging, you wanted us to ask people to make that version of us.
I would do it, but I can't draw. I want an X-Men, Useful Idiots, and Charles Jaco all together, Avengers style fighting.
What it comes down to is we were hoping somebody with artistic talent out there could do an X-Men style comic with Katie and me and Charles Jaco all together, either in combat or I don't know. Doing something
in khaki on khaki.
Yeah, there should be khaki on
khaki
involved.
That was what it was, right? That was, yeah. Also, I would like to request a sketch of the armed penguin that we're going to be driving.
Oh, the penguin.
Pangolin. The armed penguin.
Armored.
Armored. Although now I like the idea of a pangolin packing heat. But yes, we want a sketch of the armored, of me and Matt in the armored pangolin taking aim. What is it? COVID pellets?
Yeah, I mean, it would be
Pfizer executives.
Think about the battle scene on the ice planet Hoth, the beginning of Empire Strikes Back. Remember those big walker things, right? Yes. Except they would be pangolins.
It would be a pangolin. Yeah.
Right.
With COVID pellets, which you can represent however you want.
Like that.
Yeah, we leave it to you.
And then Luke Skywalker would fly around their little pangolin legs and tilt them over. But yeah, we would love to see that, a drawing of that as well.
Love
so
to see it. Yeah.
And thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you on Monday morning.
Thank you so much. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Please subscribe on Substack and subscribe on YouTube. Substack, YouTube, youtube.com/usefulidiots, usefulidiots.substack.com.
Jesus, that was impressive. I could never do that. Yeah.
Hashtag Useful Idiots Pod and at Useful Idiot Pod on Twitter.
Hashtag impressed.
Hashtag thank you.
All right. We'll see you next week. Right.
Great. Bye. Hello. Thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday morning show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.